So welcome everyone to the Second Court of Appeals this afternoon. We have one case arguing at 1:30 and then another one at 2:30, but we're going to take a break after the 1:30 argument. Before we get started, I'll introduce the panel. To my left is Justice Mike Wallach. To my right, Justice Wade Birdwell, and I'm Elizabeth Kerr. I understand counsel have checked in, and so I will ask the clerk to call the case, please.
I'm sorry, am I supposed to? Oh, there we go. May it please the court. With the court's permission, I'd like to focus first on issue four, the lack of a hearing on Mr. Wade's trial counsel's potential conflict. As I mentioned in a letter brief last Friday with a 2019 case from this court, quoting an earlier Court of Criminal Appeals case, quote, once a possible conflict of interest is brought to the trial court's attention by either a pretrial motion or a trial objection, the trial court has the constitutional obligation to take at least adequate steps to ascertain whether the risk of conflict is too remote. That, say Johnson and Dunn, is all that's required, a pretrial motion.
Counsel, do you have any cases where a motion was filed but was never brought to the attention of the court, and which says that that's sufficient? All the cases that you cited in your letter brief, the matter was actually brought to the attention of the trial court.
Indeed, Your Honor.
And so I guess you can read that as one long requirement brought to the attention of the trial court by. So that means if you file something, then that brings it to the attention, or does it actually have to be actually brought to the attention so that the trial judge can do something with it as opposed to just having it on file?
Indeed, Your Honor. But in Orgo versus State out of the 14th Court of Appeals, I believe, the defendant filed a pro se motion before pretrial, and it was heard. Whether it was prompted to be heard, I don't know.
But it was brought to the attention. That's the key, right?
I don't believe the opinion says that. It was simply heard. A pretrial motion was filed.
But if it's heard, then it is actually brought to the trial court's attention, right?
Yes, but whether it was brought to the court's attention by filing or by something else, I don't believe.
So back to my question is, do you have any cases where a motion is filed, no one ever brings it, judge, you need to do something with this so that the judge can rule on it, and then on appeal they said, well, it was filed, that's good enough. Do you have a case like that?
I've never seen one. Okay. No, I've done an exhaustive search and couldn't
find one. I figured you probably had.
Okay, thanks.
Well, was the trial court entitled to just ignore anything that Mr. Wade was filing pro se since he had appointed counsel?
That's my next point, Your Honor. the motion in this case was filed by the defendant himself, and he said that trial counsel had another client, one Marcos Rodriguez, who's a possible witness for the state. And at trial, did counsel advance another interest to Mr. Wade's detriment? We don't know. Why don't we know? Because the state successfully urged the trial court to ignore all Mr. Wade's motions. They weren't heard. None of them were heard. This is not the fault of Mr. Perry. He was not the assistant DA at the time. However, in the letter brief filed yesterday, the state pointed to Garcia versus State and Henry Ramos. Neither of them were addressing a possible conflict of counsel claim. And in that, the state says, or those courts say, merely filing a motion doesn't show that the motion was brought to the trial court's attention for a ruling. This principle is correct in most cases. But in a case of conflict of counsel, it's like an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, which doesn't even have to be preserved, because you certainly cannot rely on counsel to stand up and say, I may be conflicted out. He may not know.
But just on a basic point, the court still has to have the opportunity to rule and rule in a meaningful way. So what is your best argument that a pro se motion that nowhere in the record does it indicate there was any attempt to bring the pro se motion to the trial court's attention by requesting a hearing or during a hearing contemporaneously with the filing of the motion, that it was specifically argued to the court for purposes of giving an explanation of why there was a conflict. In other words, we don't have anything in the record. You're right, there's no hearing, okay? But we also, that cuts both ways, because that means the trial court never got a real opportunity to conduct the hearing until much, much later on with regard to that. And at no point in time was there any discussion about why there was a conflict.
I grant you that, Your Honor, because according to the state, Mr. Wade is not entitled to dual representation, so he wasn't entitled to tell the court there might be a conflict, to orally say something. And besides, Mr. Wade is a thoroughly well-read layman, but to his understanding, the state urged the court to ignore all these motions, and the court did so. To his understanding, maybe to everybody's understanding, that's a ruling on the merits. That the trial court implicitly denied the motion. Certainly, I think a layman would think that.
You would agree, though, that this motion, this mention of a potential conflict, was included in quite a few motions that had been filed.
Yes, Your Honor.
By your client. And, again, the basic premise that the state argued was that there can't be a hybrid representation, therefore all of these motions should go away. And at that point in time, there was no attempt to distinguish out the conflict issue from any of the others. So the ruling that the court gave doesn't actually indicate he understood there was, in fact, a conflict raised at any point in time.
Indeed, Your Honor. I anticipate that the state will claim that Mr. Wade filed so many pretrial motions that the trial court couldn't have been aware of them. We all have laborious tasks to do to prepare for trial. If the state doesn't at least read the defendant's motions and say, hey, this one needs to have a hearing or the conviction might be reversed, well, then the state has only itself to blame. Surely the state has to read those motions. Maybe counsel has to read them too, but we can't do ineffective assistance of counsel here because
it was... But now you're arguing that somebody else other than the defendant has to actually preserve the issue for the defendant and effectively represent the defendant. The state reads the motion, says, oh, I need to set that for a hearing. Or you want us to presume that the trial court actually saw when that was mentioned among all of the motions and say, well, that needs to get set for a hearing. But we don't have any indication. You know, basically he filed it and then never argued it.
I agree, Your Honor, but with the state's motion that the court must ignore all those motions, then is it Mr. Wade's job to bring it before the court again? Because he's already made the motion. It's been implicitly denied by the state's motion the court's action on the state's motion.
Well, do you have any authority that says that there's the rule about hybrid representation, that this is an exception to that rule, that the court... You know, ordinarily doesn't have to listen to what a represented defendant has to say in a pro se motion, except in this circumstance.
Only, Your Honor, that it's akin to an ineffective assistance of counsel argument, which, of course, doesn't have to be preserved because you cannot expect counsel to say, hey, I was ineffective. Who's going to do that? Also, the state's brief says even if the trial court had been aware of the complaint, there's nothing in the record to substantiate it. Well, of course there isn't.
Let's go back to ineffective assistance of counsel. So basically, you want us to treat this that basically his defense counsel, who he's going around to begin with a hybrid pro se motion, okay? We should presume he's actually helping with his own defense. But no, he files something on his own. But somehow we're supposed to treat this as that his own counsel was ineffective because he didn't ask for a hearing on this?
No, Your Honor, it's not an ineffective assistance point. It's a point that's...
just said we should treat it that way. So how do we treat it that way without it basically blowing up in our face? Because so far, everybody but the defendant is the one who's supposed to bring, is supposed to have, make sure this is a hearing. His attorney, who he's gone around, the state or the trial court, just so long as he's put it somewhere in a motion that he himself has filed, which he's not supposed to be filing, and then that's sufficient to preserve it, and it's constitutional error, and we kick it back for the entire thing.
We do, Your Honor. I would think, my personal take on it would be, if the state says the trial court doesn't have to look at those motions, they should all be ignored, then it's the state's fault that it wasn't brought to the, because the state should, or defense counsel perhaps, but the state certainly, because the state is the one prosecuting, the state should have to look at those motions and say, oh, this requires a hearing, or the conviction might be reversed. The state didn't do that. It said, we don't have to follow him, and the trial court doesn't have to either. If the state wants to sustain its conviction, then it seems like it's the state's burden before it tells the trial court, you don't have to look at any of these. As I say, this is not Mr. Perry's fault. He wasn't the ADA. But it seems that the state bears some responsibility, at least in this case, perhaps not universally, but at least in this case, because it told the trial court, you don't have to look at these. As to issues 2 and 3, double jeopardy at sentencing, with the court's indulgence, I'll stand on the briefs except to reiterate Hernandez versus State from the Court of Criminal Appeals less than 11 months ago, citing the earlier Jordan. The state says Akins trumps Jordan, pardon the choice of words, but Akins challenged only a contact conviction. It didn't challenge the two convictions. Here, as in Jordan, we have as many parts penetrated during the same transaction. That's how many convictions you can sustain.
How does one determine when a transaction starts and when a transaction ends for purposes of this rule?
I haven't seen a hard and fast rule, but under the facts of Jordan, the defendant penetrated the complainant's sexual organ first. Then some time elapsed because he couldn't, sorry to raise this here, but he couldn't get an erection the second time. Some time passed. Evidently, the participants didn't leave the library where I believe this took place. And when he could do so, he penetrated her again. In this case, it's the same conduct with the same impetus at the same one of the complainant's organs in the same pickup, in the same time period, on the same day, and neither one emerged from the pickup in between these penetrations. It was one transaction. I don't think there's a hard and fast rule, but if the convictions were reduced on double jeopardy to the, one was vacated because of this, then it seems certainly here, where nobody gets out of the pickup, it's in on an evening. They're standing right there.
It's almost like you're arguing that there has to be some type of he has to leave the room or something. He has to step away, have a cigarette outside the cab of the pickup truck or something, and then when he comes back in and makes his second proposal, then that starts a new transaction. But because he never actually did that under these circumstances, and they finished the first incidents, and then he's like, hey, let's have a go again, that's treated as one transaction, and therefore there's double jeopardy here?
Most certainly, Your Honor, because if there isn't a hard and fast rule that I know of that Jordan applies, that applied in Jordan's case, however, a criminal transaction is not only the start of it, but the crime itself and the flight from the crime itself. So that's one criminal transaction. Here, nobody fled. That seems like one transaction.
They don't. So in terms of the orifice rule, your argument is the court's recognizing that a single transaction can involve various and sundry forms of sexual intimacy, oral, vaginal, anal, etc. And each of those, because each of those is identified as a separate crime by the penal code, even if each one of those occurs in the same transaction, it's actually can be treated as three crimes because it's three separate orifices.
Yes, Your Honor, that's the unit of prosecution, I believe.
Okay.
However.
But if that occurs multiple times, but there's the argument that there's a single transaction because they just kind of like stay in bed for a little bit and then say, hey, let's have a go again. Or in this instance, they stay in the cab of the pickup truck, and then that's all one transaction. So they could do the exact same thing again, but it's the same transaction, and there would be double jeopardy, even if there is a separate instance of coercion, which is actually what was alleged here.
That is the definition of a criminal transaction. Nobody fled. That's that. It's all within. Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Counselor. Your time's up.
Thank you very much.
May it please the court, counsel. Counsel spent most of his time discussing issue four, so that's where I would like to begin this morning. The standard for triggering an inquiry or an investigation about the conflict of counsel is bringing the matter to the trial court's attention, which means more than merely filing a motion. A filing of a motion, under the language in this court's Johnson case that was cited by counsel in his letter brief on Friday, is capable of bringing the matter to the attention to the trial court if the trial court is made aware of the motion.
What duty did the state have to bring that to the attention of the trial court, since it was making an argument that none of the motions should be considered by the trial court, and therefore it was collectively saying, presumptively with that argument, they knew there had been a mention of a conflict and did not disclose that to the trial court as part of their argument?
Your Honor, I don't think the state had any duty to bring any of Mr. Wade's pro se motions to the trial court's attention. And the reason for that is when the state asked the trial court to ignore those motions and the trial court did so, the trial court was doing nothing but following the prevailing law. There's been an argument throughout the briefing and today during oral argument in this case that the trial court somehow acted improperly by signing an order saying it was going to ignore the pro se motions. But that's precisely what the prevailing law required the trial court to do.
That's why I'm asking about what duty did the DA have, okay? Presumptively, he went through all 200 pages of the handwritten stuff and knew that that was going to be an issue with regard to whether or not the trial court was going to hear any of that or not, and made the argument that you don't have to because it's pro se, it's hybrid representation. But in preparing for that hearing, he or she would have of necessity had to have known that a conflict had been raised by at least one of the motions, and then did not mention that to the trial court.
Your Honor, I don't think the record supports the presumption that the state knew all of the jots and tittles of all of the pro se motions that Mr. Wade filed. What the record supports is that the state knew that he had acted improperly by filing pro se motions while represented by counsel, and urged the court, in accordance with settled law, to ignore those motions, and that's what the court did. I don't think there can be any inference or presumption from the record that the state knew of the motion that alleged the conflict or knew of any other motions. The inference is only that the state knew that Mr. Wade was acting improperly by filing motions while represented by counsel. And there's been an argument in this case of essentially what was Mr. Wade supposed to do. And I would like to respond to that briefly, because I think he had a remedy to present these motions. And the remedy was to ask for a change of counsel or ask to proceed by self-representation and present all of those motions properly to the trial court, and then present one of those motions, either for change of counsel or for self-representation, to the trial court. But he didn't do either of those things until the middle of trial, toward the end of trial. And I would like to direct the court's attention to Reporter's Record Volume 6. And there's an exchange in Reporter's Record Volume 6 between the state and Mr. Wade's counsel about Mr. Wade's strategic and reasoned choices with respect to how he was proceeding in that manner. And counsel said, I had asked him because he had filed all of these motions, referring to the 200 pages of pro se motions, and I had asked him, okay, do you want to represent yourself? And because of the complexity of the matter, he expressed a desire for me to represent him. We had talked about that on several occasions. So there was a conversation between Mr. Wade and his counsel about the strategy by which Mr. Wade would proceed. And so Mr. Wade knew he had an opportunity to present a request to represent himself under Feretta, or knew he had an opportunity to present a request to be represented by different counsel, and strategically did neither of those. Rather, the record reflects that after consultation with his counsel, he proceeded with the choice of being represented by counsel. And under the case law, including this court's Floyd opinion that the state cited yesterday in its letter brief, the trial court simply did what the law required it to do by ignoring all of the pro se motions when he was represented by counsel. Even today, there's been a recognition that under the settled case law from Texas, there simply is no right to a hybrid form of representation. And so with respect to that fourth issue, I would cite the court to the cases cited in the state's brief, but in particular to the Kyler case from the United States Supreme Court, 446 U.S. 335 at page 347. And the court in that case was talking about the duty of a trial court to initiate an inquiry when it's made aware of a conflict. But what the court said was, unless the trial court knows or reasonably should know that a particular conflict exists, the court need not initiate an inquiry. That's the standard, knows or reasonably should know, which requires Mr. Wade, if he believes there is a conflict, to bring that matter properly to the trial court's attention. And again, he would have had the ability to do so had he proceeded with self-representation under Feretta, but he chose not to do so as a reasoned and strategic choice after a consultation, with his appointed counsel. The other cases cited in the state's brief, the Botello case from the Corpus Christi court, said that a complaint about counsel was properly overruled because there was nothing in the record to indicate the trial judge was made aware of the defendant's dissatisfaction with his counsel. In this court's Bowen case, a 2013 decision from this court, and unpublished, but it's 2013 Westlaw 387-4760, and the court overruled a complaint about a potential conflict with counsel because there was nothing in the record to indicate that the appellant ever presented his motion. So the trial court just didn't and could not have erred by disregarding pro se motions that the law entitled it and, in fact, required it to disregard. I think the idea that there's some error by the trial court doing what the law led it to do is just not a persuasive argument in this case. With respect to issue three and the argument that there's a double jeopardy issue with the proposed one conviction per orifice rule that has been proposed in this case, I think it's telling that in the appellant's brief, he hasn't cited any case law that vacated a conviction based on double jeopardy based on an application of that rule. There's not a single case in his briefing, in his reply brief, or in his letter brief that vacates a conviction based on an application of that rule. And with respect to the court's questioning of opposing counsel on that issue, the question was, well, how much time needs to pass before similar offenses can be prosecuted and multiple convictions can be obtained on them? And I would cite the court to the Patterson case. It's discussed in the state's brief, but it's a Texas Court of Criminal Appeals case from 2004, 152 Southwest 3rd, 88. And the discussion is on pages 90 and 92. And in that case, there were two anal penetrations of the victim that were separated only by a short bathroom break. And this is what the court, in its opinion, said about that. It said, the victim testified that appellant got into bed with her, lay behind her, unbuttoned his pants, grasped her hand, and tried unsuccessfully to make her touch his private. When she pulled her hand away, the victim testified he pushed his private inside her butt. After a short time, the victim got up and went to the bathroom. The second occurrence was essentially identical to the first. The victim testified that she returned to the bed, that the appellant again tried to force her to put her hand on his private, and failing once again, he put his private inside her butt a second time. Under those facts of the same offense, the same penetration happening only separated by a bathroom break, the court in Patterson upheld both of those penetrative convictions. And I don't think there's any further, I mean, there's other case law cited in the state's brief, but I think that case alone shows that Mr. Wade's convictions in this case don't result from double jeopardy, given the state of the record in which he was in the truck and the victim's testimony is that he had a penetrative act and then there was a short break and then another penetrative act. Under the Patterson case and under the language in the Aikens case that spoke about how many convictions are possible when there's a penetration of the same orifice through separate acts, I think those cases dispose of the argument that there's a double jeopardy violation based on the acts that occurred in this case. So I would like to turn my attention briefly to issue one. And in particular, what I would like to talk about with respect to issue one is the requirement or the factor of prejudice under the Barker inquiry. Because the case law says that prejudice under Barker is the most important factor in a speedy trial analysis. And it goes farther to say that there are three types of prejudice that can be shown under Barker, and that of those three types, the most important part of the prejudice inquiry is actual prejudice or actual impairment to the defense. And so I would like to discuss those briefly, because I think while the state's briefing, and I would rely on that to say that none of the factors support the drastic remedy of dismissal in this case, the prejudice factor particularly doesn't. And that's because there was pretrial incarceration in this case, and the state owns that. Mr. Wade was incarcerated before trial for the time of his arrest up to the time of trial. But under the case law, the mere incarceration leading up to trial is not sufficient to justify the remedy of dismissal. This court's Powell decision, 2021 Westlaw 5370163, affirmed the denial of dismissal when a defendant was incarcerated for 3 years, but he presented insufficient evidence of any other form of prejudice. And this case is very similar to that. When Mr. Wade was incarcerated for a period of exceeding 3 years, but he didn't present any evidence of the other two forms of prejudice, which are anxiety and concern, or impairment to the defense. With respect to anxiety and concern, he had a pretrial motion, and he talks about that on page 46 of his briefing, but he had a pretrial motion in which he alleged that there were negative health effects and negative effects on his work experience based on the pending prosecution. But the allegations in that motion were never testified to. There was never any evidence presented of them, and I would ask this court to compare that circumstance where there's no evidence presented to the State versus Moreno case. It's a 2022 decision out of the Houston First District Court of Appeals at 651 Southwest 3rd, 399. In that case, there was evidentiary testimony of anxiety and so much testimony that part of what was presented was that the defendant had received injections to help battle the anxiety that he was facing given the pending prosecution. There simply was no such evidence presented or any evidence presented with respect to anxiety and concern in this case. So that weighs heavily against the radical remedy of dismissal. And as to impairment to the defense, which the case law describes as the most important interest of the prejudice inquiry, which is itself the most important interest under the Barker overall test, there's one assertion in this court about how his defense was impaired, and the assertion is that if he had been released and was not confined before trial, he may have been able to go look for an alternate perpetrator to the offense. But that assertion fails for a legal reason and for a factual reason. And the legal reason is it was forfeited by not being raised in the trial. This court's Fuller versus State opinion, 624 Southwest 3rd, 855, at page 867 from just last year, settles that issue. In that case, Mr. Fuller argued that a delay in his trial had resulted in a police detective's not remembering whether he had spoken to someone who knew an alternate suspect. And this court said, in short, Fuller never informed the trial court that Loves, that was the detective, uncertainty about locating Warren Yoder prejudiced his defense and thereby violated his right to a speedy trial. This basis for Fuller's assertion of prejudice was not before the trial court and not preserved for our review. And that same principle applies here. The assertion that Mr. Wade couldn't go out and find an alternate suspect was never before the trial court as a basis for prejudice, and it's therefore forfeited for this court's review. And that's the only assertion he has. The factual reason that assertion fails is that it contradicts what his defensive theory was in the trial court. In the trial court, Mr. Wade's defensive theory was not that this sexual assault happened and that someone else committed it, but that no sexual assault happened at all. His theory was that the victim was not credible, and his theory was that she was conspiring with Mr. Wade's ex-wife because of a custody matter. So the prejudice argument that's raised for the first time on appeal contradicts what his defensive theory was at trial, and it also weighs against the strong evidentiary record supporting his guilt. Beyond the victim's testimony alone, which the jury heard her describe all of the acts that Mr. Wade had committed with her, the jury also heard of a separate sexual offense that he had committed against a different victim and had been convicted for, and the jury heard testimony from his nephew, Marcus Gilbreth, about Mr. Wade admitting to Marcus that he had had sex with Erica, the victim in this case. So even if the sole assertion of prejudice had not been forfeited for this court's review, it's not persuasive. So the overall point that I'd like to make is that prejudice is by far the largest factor under the four Barker factors, and there's just simply not enough prejudice, no persuasive and compelling prejudice in this case, to reverse and vacate five sexual assault convictions. Unless the court has any questions, I think I'll give back the remainder of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court,
counsel.
I heard the state talk about a case in which there was a bathroom break between the penetrations or offenses. Did either get up and go to the bathroom here? No, they don't. They didn't. In fact, the state didn't show much about or anything that I remember about how much time elapsed during these two penetrations. And without that, I don't think you can assume that there was anything more than a couple of seconds. To go back to issue four, Mr. Perry said, the trial court reasonably should know there's a conflict. The state bears the burden of showing harmlessness in a case like this because it's a constitutional issue. It's imperative that the state go over these motions and realize what the import of them and say, Judge, we need to do this, otherwise the conviction might be overturned. Here, the state didn't do anything like that. In fact, it told the trial court, you don't have to do anything. Ignore them. The state at least bears some of the blame, and if the state doesn't have the responsibility to tell the court about something that might vitiate its own conviction, then I don't know what the solution should be. The state openly told the court, ignore all these motions.
What about the decision that was made during the Feretta hearing that was referenced by counsel, where he said that he had talked with his client about this and they'd made a decision to move forward on a strategic basis? Why does that not wipe out that whole theory?
Well, they had the Feretta hearing, but as far as I can remember, there was no chance that Mr. Wade could jump in and say, hey, there's a conflict. And even if there was, the trial court had implicitly denied these motions by saying, don't have to look at them.
But at that point, the issue of the potential conflict was brought to the attention of the trial court, right? When they had this conversation?
It was, yes, in a sense.
Well, at the very least, there was a conversation between the defendant and his defense counsel, which his defense counsel related to the court concerning what to do about all of the pro se motions, which included this conflict. And the representation of his defense counsel was that they had talked about it and that defendant had decided to go ahead and proceed as being represented by defense counsel until the middle of the trial. Why should we not assume under those circumstances that effectively that effectuated it, even if it had been presented, it was effectively withdrawn based upon the representation of defense counsel?
Because counsel was, I don't think you can say biased, but if counsel doesn't, if counsel is required to bring a conflict to the attention of the court, then how can any of this, how can that be? Does counsel have to bring to the attention of court that he was ineffective? I know some brave trial attorneys do when they say, I would give this man a new trial. I've had that. But how can counsel be required to, or how can one expect counsel to bring a matter to the attention of the court that impinges on himself?
Well, don't the disciplinary rules require candor to the court?
Of course.
So,
but
was not Mr. Wade there when his attorney is representing to the court that they had talked about it, and Mr. Wade had agreed that instead of pursuing the motions pro se and representing himself exactly as was suggested by the state, that Mr. Wade decided to continue being represented by his defense counsel at that point in time, which would appear at least to be an implicit waiver of any conflict that he thought that he had.
But how can counsel...
And Wade is standing there when he's saying that. So there's a degree of silence in the face of what he should have been objecting to in front of the court had he actually had a problem with that.
But the conflict may have been was in the motions, but was it something that counsel was aware of? If counsel hadn't read the pro se motions either, then what was he waiving?
Well, but he was waiving the right to have any of those motions heard. That was definitely before the court, because the state was arguing, Judge, you don't have to listen to any of these. And in the process of that discussion, there was a discussion about the fact that defense counsel had raised the issue of him representing himself because of all of those motions, and that he had said he would prefer to go ahead with continued representation. Defense counsel didn't bring up any of those pro se motions at all, and Mr. Wade's standing there the whole time, and he didn't say, well, wait a minute, there's one or two that I need to bring up with you, with the court, and would appreciate that.
Counsel, I'll give you 30 seconds to wrap up.
Thank you, Your Honor. Because Mr. Wade thought, I presume, and it looks like it's on the record, Mr. Wade thought the motion had already been denied. Why is he going to speak up? The trial court said, agreed, we don't have to look at any of those motions. So in his mind, it was implicitly denied. Why raise it again? Why? And he's not entitled to he's not entitled to hybrid representation, so does he have a even a right to speak?
If his attorney is making a misrepresentation to the court in his presence, why are we to just say, oh, he just blew that, that he couldn't speak at that point in time?
He could speak, but why bother? The trial court had already implicitly denied all those motions. He asked, I'm sorry if I've gone over time. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, gentlemen. Your case is submitted. We appreciate the oral